When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Welcome to the FT's US Election Countdown podcast. I'm Sam Fleming in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jeff Dyer in D.C. with Sam.
And I'm Dimitri Sevastopoulou in Denver, Colorado.
So it's once again an eventful week on the campaign trail. We had the vice presidential debate between Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, Tim Kaine being Hillary Clinton's running mate. I think it's fair to say it was a polished performance by Mike Pence, Donald Trump's running mate. He certainly seemed pretty presidential in the way he presented himself. The big concern for him was that he was really unable to deflect some of the statements that Tim Kaine was throwing at him in terms of statements by Donald Trump himself. I'd be interested to get your reaction, Dimitri, to the debate.
I think that if Hillary Clinton ran circles around Donald Trump in the first presidential debate, then Tim Kaine suffered the same fate at the hands of Mike Pence. Pence, as you said, he was more polished. He looked more presidential. He sounded better. Kaine, in contrast, kept interrupting Pence. He looked like a kind of a small school kid who was trying to interrupt the teacher the whole time. And while it's true that Pence was clever, that he didn't take the bait from Kaine. He didn't respond to any of the attacks on Trump that Kaine made. And in fact, he basically denied that Trump had said a whole slew of things that we know to be true. But for people watching on television, it looked like a much more polished performance. And I think, generally speaking, people thought that he had the upper hand. And, you know, when people stop watching those debates, they leave with kind of an impression of style more than one of substance. And I think on style, Pence was the clear winner.
Is it helpful for Donald Trump that his running mate was so polished in the performance and so effective at sidestepping bear traps? And by contrast, Trump himself obviously fell into a number of bear traps when he was debating against Hillary Clinton and was anything but polished. He appeared not to really have prepared enough for his debate against Clinton. Does that hurt Donald Trump, or does it not matter? Do people feel reassured that his running mate, at least, is very well prepared?
I don't think it hurts Donald Trump. I mean, I think the one lesson you can take away is that actually Donald Trump, who was watching and tweeting at the same time as Mike Pence was speaking, he could probably take a couple of leaves out of Mike Pence's playbook and try some of the same things when he meets Hillary Clinton on Monday night in St. Louis, Missouri. But, you know, as we know, Donald Trump doesn't, he's unpredictable, and I suspect we'll have to wait and see what happens on that front.
I guess I agree with everything Dimitri is saying about the debate, and Mike Pence did come across as much more presentable, much more effective performer. But the one problem they might have is that he, on various occasions, he basically denied certain things that Donald Trump has actually said about women, about immigrants, about Mexicans. And so he's given the Clinton campaign an excuse just to spend the next few days recycling all those comments that Donald Trump has actually said and pointing out that Mike Pence was just denying reality. So while I think he won on the night, he might have left an opening to the Clinton campaign to do quite well in the post-debate conflict.
Now, one of the key states where people will be watching in the next few days just to see whether there was any impact from the debate is Ohio. Dimitri, you've been there recently. You've written a big page for the FT on Ohio. The story goes that the state has voted for the winning presidential candidate in every election since 1944, with the one exception of siding with Richard Nixon in 1960. What did you find when you were doing your reporting in Ohio?
Well, Ohio's fascinating. I mean, it's actually only voted for the loser in the presidential election twice in 124 years, and it's seen as the best bellwether of the American presidential election. So I spent 2 days in the urban areas around Columbus, Ohio, and a couple of days in the east in the Appalachian region where Trump is particularly strong. There's two interesting things happening. In the east, white, blue-collar Democrats are shifting over to Donald Trump. They're not shifting to the Republican Party, per se. They just think that Trump is offering answers to their woes, which includes jobs leaving because of globalization and trade deals that they consider to be unfair. So you're seeing huge numbers shift across, and Trump is very strong in that part of the country. On the other hand, in some of the urban areas, Donald Trump has struggled with white-educated Republican women, and college-educated Republicans because of a lot of his divisive rhetoric over the last year. Now, in the month leading up to the debate, he actually improved with both of those groups, and he has moved ahead in Ohio. He's roughly 5 points ahead of Hillary Clinton. She is desperately trying to peel off some of these Republican women, bring them into her camp, and hope that that will offset the gains that he's making in the east of Ohio. On the other hand, Ohio may not be a bellwether anymore. The population is much more white than much of the other states in the U.S., and it's less diverse. While other states in America are becoming increasingly diverse over time, Ohio really hasn't changed very much. So it's kind of prime territory for Donald Trump, and it could be a case that Donald Trump could win Ohio and that the state would actually vote for the loser for the third time in the last 125 years or so.
So Ohio perhaps not as big a bellwether as it used to be. Jeff, you've been in another state, which is a critical one in this election, namely North Carolina. Both candidates throwing big resources into North Carolina. It is one of the key battlegrounds. Your focus is on veterans in North Carolina, who are 9% of the population there, so a critical part of the electorate. What are you finding in terms of what's driving their voting decisions?
What's interesting about a veteran vote, especially in a place like North Carolina, is one of the main claims of the Trump campaign is it's going to find these pockets of mainly white voters who haven't really turned out elections in the past but are going to be very enthused by Donald Trump, by his personality, and by the kind of populist message that he's put forward. And one of the potential pools of those voters is amongst the veterans, big veteran populations in places like North Carolina and Virginia, some of whom have not voted in the past. And it turns out that actually the Republican National Committee, even long before Donald Trump ever became the candidate, was already working quite hard to try and find those veteran voters in places like North Carolina to turn them out. It's a very fertile territory for a Republican candidate. There's a lot of resentment amongst veterans about things that have happened, particularly in the Obama administration, but also in the Bush administration, the Veterans Administration, mismanagement, scandals at hospitals, long waiting lists. There's a whole series of issues which veterans are very upset about, and so that they could potentially be interested and more engaged in this election. The problem the Republicans are having is the various things that Donald Trump has said that are going to put off veterans. He famously had a big bust up with John McCain during the primaries, where he said that John McCain wasn't a real hero because he got captured during the war, even though he spent 5 years in a Vietnamese POW camp. He had this famous spat with the Khan family during the Democratic Convention. They're the father and mother of a Muslim soldier who was killed in Iraq. And then even just this week, he created some friction with veterans groups when he was appearing before a veteran audience in Virginia, and he suggested that a post-traumatic stress disorder was a sign of weakness if a soldier got there. It wasn't a sign of strength, and that caused a lot of resentment among veterans groups. So it's one of those demographics on those groups that potentially Republicans could do well in this election, but Donald Trump is in lots of ways getting in the way.
Dimitri, what have you picked up from your own conversations with veterans, be it at Trump rallies or Clinton rallies or elsewhere?
Well, I think certainly when you talk to veterans, you'll find very few people who think that the comment about the army captain who was killed in Iraq was a smart thing to do. And I'm sure that his comments about PTSD will not go down well in families who are dealing with the ramifications of that illness. But a lot of veterans are struggling in America in terms of getting jobs when they come back from Iraq or Afghanistan. You have a lot of veterans in some of the areas which are doing badly economically. So when I was in Ohio, I was told that Ohio traditionally is not a huge military state. There aren't that many military bases there. But as economic conditions in the east of the state have deteriorated, a lot of families have seen their sons and to a lesser extent their daughters go off to war or join the military because they had no other way of finding employment. So it's a sensitive issue. But I think there's an overlap between kind of Trump's core supporters, the people who are upset about the state of the economy and the lack of jobs in their regions, and veterans. So I think actually I hear from a lot of veterans that they support him. And they like his kind of what they see his straight talk message. So Sam, one of the things I hear on the road a lot is that there are some of the polls that we see underestimate the support for Trump because your independent voters and more moderate Republicans are afraid to tell people they support Trump because they don't want to be accused of being racist, or they may not like his rhetoric, but they prefer him to Hillary Clinton. But they just don't want to tell their friends that. You did a piece on polling this week. What did you find?
Well, there's this question which has been raised by Kellyanne Conway, Trump's campaign manager, as to whether the polls are under recording the support for Donald Trump. This we've summarised this as the shy Trump voter. The idea that when a pollster comes calling on the phone and says, "Who are you voting?" Some voters will be reluctant to say they're supporting Trump because of some of the controversial things he's said, and therefore that the polls may be under, at least the telephone polls, where you're talking to another human being as opposed to the internet polls, the telephone polls may be under recording Trump's support. What we did was really talk to some of the pollsters who are doing this work, and universally no one seems to be finding that this theory is backed up by the evidence. And you can look at the primaries, for instance, where the polls were fairly accurate in terms of predicting how people support, and certainly weren't under recording Mr. Trump's outcomes there. So the shy Trump voter, the shy Trump supporter, which is an alluring theory in some ways, and certainly ought to be concerning to Hillary Clinton if it's true, doesn't seem to be panning out. Now, that doesn't mean that the polling story is a straightforward one by any means. What you do really pick up by speaking to pollsters is the multiplicity of outcomes that depend on the assumptions that pollsters are plugging into their models in terms of which demographic groups will show up in the polls, what will turn out be compared with last time, and then some of the methodological issues that they come across when they're doing, should they be doing telephone polls, or should they be doing internet polling, what are the problems with internet polling, which is a huge growth area, but which is in some ways uncharted territory, and there are very different ways of doing it. So no one is saying the polls are 100% accurate. Really, the question is, how do you gauge the outcome from all these different methodologies and polling assumptions? The overriding message is watch the overall picture from the averages from all the polls pulled together by the various aggregators. Don't necessarily fixate on individual polls, and that ought to give you a broad brush idea of where the electorate sits. And certainly to date, Hillary Clinton has for most of this campaign been marginally ahead of Donald Trump.
So this week I'm going to interview a woman that I met at a rally a few months ago. I'm interviewing her again. And she told me the other day that she was the first person in her neighborhood to put up a Trump sign and in her front yard. And after she did that, the other neighbors started coming over for coffee and quietly saying to her, "Do you think it's okay for us to put up Trump signs now? We're a little bit nervous about what people might think." So that's the kind of thing I hear. But something interesting I heard on the other side is that in Republican areas, so for example, in Columbus, Ohio, Delaware County, which is very Republican, but has a lot of educated Republicans who are a little bit wary of Trump, you have people who are going to support Hillary Clinton, but there's no way they're going to put a Hillary Clinton sign in their front yard because for them, they're not leaving the Republican Party. They're just going for Hillary Clinton while Donald Trump is the candidate of the Republican Party. So, you know, we're not going to know the answer to any of these things till November 8th, but it's certainly fascinating to look at.
I agree. And you can actually look at the lawn sign syndrome is perhaps a sign of the polarized nature of this election, just how strong the antipathy is for the other candidate, for those who don't support the other candidate, the favorability ratings extremely low, and really, as I say, just how strong the feelings are about these two candidates, which could be one example of that could be people's reluctance in certain situations to put signs declaring their affiliation on their front lawn.
One of the fascinating things in Eastern Ohio was I was sitting in the Republican headquarters in two counties, Mahoning and Columbiana. And as I was sitting there, you had unemployed coal miners and other people who are in economically distressed conditions coming in and spending $4 and $5 to buy a Trump yard sign. Now, in no election in past history have people paid for yard signs. Sometimes it's hard to give them away. So there's something interesting happening.
Sam, is there a phenomenon at all of the shy Clinton voter? I'm thinking of, you know, a millennial who's cut its cable cord, only has a mobile phone, very hard for the pollsters to get a handle on, that maybe they're not being properly polled or properly canvassed in this election?
Yeah, I think that's a real issue, and it's something pollsters are very aware of. How do you reach millennials? Certainly, if you call people's landlines, you won't necessarily get through. In fact, a lot of people don't have landlines anymore. They rely entirely on mobile phones. That's not a new problem, so it's something pollsters think they're on top of, but no one's ever convinced that that you're getting exactly representative if you just do a random set of calls. You're more likely to get an older voter, for instance, on the phone than a millennial voter. So it just makes the pollster's job harder in terms of actually doing their research. But this is not a mystery to them. They're extremely aware that this is a pitfall, and it's something that they say they are trying to correct for. Well, I think I'll wrap it up there. That's it for us this week. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm Sam1Fleming. We'll have @Dimi for Dimitri and DiaJeff for Jeff. Do sign up for our daily campaign trail newsletter, White House Countdown, at ft.com/NBE. That stands for news by email. Again, that's ft.com/NBE. Do also download FT Politics wherever you get your podcasts, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Acast.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.